You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, February 25th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, planet Earth.
Oh, it's a pretty general greeting there, Evan.
Yeah.
Very inclusive.
Well, I never know who's listening.
I like being inclusive.
Although most people would not have understood you.
Do you ever notice how some people pronounce the R in February and some people don't?
Yes.
You say February.
No.
Not that intensely, but
it's just very subtle. It's supposed to be very
February.
Subtle.
I hate the fact that there's a letter R in that word.
I know. I say February, which is probably also sounds like kind of
February.
That's normal.
February.
It's a very soft R. It's about the softest R in the English language, I think.
It's a funny
word. Barely hear it.
February.
So,
yeah,
having nothing to do with any of that. you guys know who Katherine Johnson is, of course.
Yes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was now.
Yeah, so she died. Oh. She died, I think, just today, right? Or yesterday?
No, it was two days ago, I think.
At the age of 101. 101.
Wow.
As my grandmother would always say, God bless her. Right? But everybody. So anyway, so she, as you know, she was made famous by the movie Hidden Figures. She was a NASA mathematician, famously, you know, was involved with doing calculations for orbital trajectories. John Glenn asked for her specifically when he went up for the first time, wanted her to confirm the calculations because he didn't trust that newfangled mechanical computer. You know, he wanted a person.
The real deal.
The real deal. But anyway, we don't need to rehash the whole plot of the movie Hidden Figures. But she was obviously a trailblazer. Fantastic, you know, her contributions, again, in the face of, you know, of prejudice and, you know, and her being held back, she still, her talent came through nonetheless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Horrific institutional racism that she was up against, and she still managed, like, to shine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It couldn't be ignored, her talent. That's couldn't how be. Powerful it was.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And lived such a long, full life.
Yeah. Yeah, made
Incredible.
It in 2020. 101 she years got, old.
Yeah, and she, in her lifetime, she won the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Congressional Gold Medal. Like, she's been honored, you know, left and right. We see Katherine Johnson dedications all over the place. But it is interesting that you mentioned, Steve, that for a lot of people, they didn't even know who she was until they read or saw the film Hidden Figures.
Oh, yeah.
Although,
yeah.
Obviously, within certain circles, she's been an inspiration for, you know, decades and decades.
Yeah, of course. But just, you know, as an example of that, though, she got the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2015, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah, very late in life.
That was that was after the movie, right?
No,
No.
Was it?
2016.
It might have been after the book, but
yeah, it was after the book.
The book.
Yeah, the movie was in 2016, so it was after the book, but before the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But still, that's pretty late in the game, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So we've been giving updates on the coronavirus, now COVID. Well, I guess it's the coronavirus. But it's COVID-19 is the illness, so
right.
You could say either one. So
it's a coronavirus.
Yeah, it's one. Yeah, I know it's a coronavirus, but people refer to it as the coronavirus, which is misleading because MERS and SARS are both coronaviruses, but as well as just some regular cold viruses. But who was it? The WHO came out and said it's going to be COVID-19.
Who was it? The WHO?
Yeah, who? The WHO said either that. It's always either the CDC or the WHO, one or both of them. They decided it was going to be COVID-19. It's the name of the illness.
Which apparently is like the name of a radio station somewhere.
That
sucks.
Oh, that was like, remember there was a
Stargate Universe.
No, it was the AIDS. Remember there was like a chocolate candy.
Oh,
thing
that,
what was it? Like it suppresses your hunger.
Yeah. There was a diet product that was called AIDS.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then in the very beginning, they're like, we're not going to change the name of our product. And then they went out of business.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, that calls for a rebranding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Calling the marketing experts.
So it's you know, the numbers are still growing, although I've been hearing reports for a couple of weeks now that it's leveling off in China, but then it really isn't. And it's confusing because they are deciding, should we include asymptomatic people or not include asymptomatic people who got infected? But the numbers are over 80,000 as of this recording right now in China. But again, the real number is probably a lot higher. And it's South Korea, I think, is the next country most hit. There are outbreaks in Italy. And now the debate is, and this is an active debate with experts disagreeing, whether or not to call it a pandemic. You know, pandemic, you need active person-to-person spread in multiple countries.
But we're starting to see that, right?
Yeah, like we're starting
the number of spread outside of China person-to-person is starting to reach or maybe exceed? No, it's starting to reach.
No, it's not getting close to what it is in China. Not even close.
The rate isn't?
It's like, it's like the way it was in China in the early phases. But it's, you know, once it's like on the rise in multiple countries, you know, which we're kind of getting there, I think it'll be declared a pandemic soon. Mm-hmm. And the CDC said today, which I don't know, this was a little uncharacteristic, I thought, but they said, yeah, it's an outbreak in the United States is pretty much inevitable at this point, and be prepared for a major disruption. And that sent the stock market tumbling.
Yeah, that's vague.
It's such a hard thing, right? Because it's like you want to mitigate sort of panic, but at the same time, you want people to be prepared.
Yeah, it's always a fine line.
And it does seem to be the case that with a lot of these things, you know, calling something a pandemic, it's like it's a little bit hindsight. By the time that label is usually slapped on something, it's already like, yeah, it's kind of later than, you know.
It's better as a retrospective sort of analysis.
Yeah, we've been in a pandemic for a few days now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
they get it both ways, right? If they don't warn you, then it's like they were negligent. And if they warn too early, then they were being hysterical or, you know, being
irresponsible.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is, they have a reasonable protocol. They have their parameters. You know, they know what they're doing. And you can't actually predict the future. So they're just, with the uncertainty they have, they're making the best call that they have. And it's usually within some reasonable range. They don't always get it exactly right, but that's a ridiculous criterion. The bottom line is, I don't think we're close to the end of this, but keeping things into perspective, it's still dwarfed by a typical flu, you know, season in terms of number of infections.
Yeah, the real thing is the percentage of people who die, I think, which is the part that people are scared about. But also, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like the vast majority of the people who are, you know, violently ill or actually dying from this infection are people who have compromised immune systems, are frail, are elderly, already have lung problems. Right?
As expected, yeah, totally expected, right?
It's the same as like when we think of people who die from the flu. I mean,
why wouldn't they be more susceptible?
Young children,
of course they are. But some young, healthy people have died from this. Make no mistake, it's not 100% isolated to people who are vulnerable. Okay. But of course, it's hugely disproportionate. But why would it not be? Right?
Why would it not be? And frontline healthcare workers as well. We're seeing that a lot, right?
Sure.
Yeah, and there's some talk about, you know, as it spreads to other countries, the question is, will the mortality rate be reproducible, or you know, is China's mortality rate higher than, say, what it will be in the U.S. just because the healthcare infrastructure is different here,
and also because they had to beta test this damn thing. You know what I mean? Like it started there, so of course the first, you know, X number are going to be like, "What? We didn't even know this was coming."
Right, right. So we'll keep an eye on that. You know, again, it's something, as I said, to keep an eye on, not to panic. You know, just be prepared. I usually have my winter storm preparation up and running. And the CDC basically says you should be prepared like you would be prepared for a major weather event. Essentially,
be isolated for a significant amount of time.
Exactly. If you have to get isolated in your home for a week at short notice, are you prepared? Right. That's
what do you think, Steve? A few weeks of food?
I like to have a few weeks of food in my house, which is not hard. You know, it doesn't mean you're going to be eating like you normally do, but you have lots of canned food. Rice is great because rice you can store forever.
Rice is great when you want to eat 1,000 of something.
No, I'm just saying, it's just because it's very calorie dense in terms of the space it takes, you know, for dried goods, but things like that, lentils are great. Any dry good like that, good, especially if it's something like a flu where like you're expecting to have utilities up and running. You know what I mean? You're not going to lose your power or your water. It's just that you may just need to shelter in place for a week or two. And then, lots of like the canned beans and stuff. And again, if you have power, you can have a lot of stuff frozen in your freezer as well. So
speaking of lentils, I found lentils in my mom's house from 2015.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
No, they're good.
How were they?
I threw those mothers out.
They should last a long time, Bob.
Then why did it have an expiration date?
Well, salt has an expiration date.
They always do that.
If it's years past the expiration date, it's a general rule of thumb for me to just throw it out.
Bob, it's a marketing gimmick. It's how they get you to buy more of the stuff. Come on, you know that.
I don't
care.
They
make toys that break, right?
If they make unbreakable toys. But we're not talking days, weeks, or even months. We're talking years. It's in the garbage.
Bob, I'm with you.
Well, it depends. If it's a dried good, then I wouldn't throw it out. If it looks good, like if there's not like pantry moths in there or something. And they're okay.
Ooh, pantry moths.
Steve, what about water?
Sealed, yeah, right? It's got to be sealed. If it's good.
Sealed, you're,
but it,
yeah,
no,
you're
there's
usually
still
good.
Like BPAs and plastic, and I don't know.
Bob, would you throw out chocolate and peanut butter if it were past the expiration date?
It depends how far.
Yeah, it depends how far. But the thing is that has always been weird to me is that when people are preparing, you know, when there's the Y2K or, you know, there's some sort of, it's hurricane season or blah, 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 which A, you should have this stuff in your house all the time because you never know. But you always see this like mad rush to the grocery stores and then like empty shelves of, for some reason, just toilet paper and duct tape.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people get really scared that they're not going to have enough toilet paper? No,
also, D batteries go very, very quickly.
D? Because
that's the only time you use flashlights.
Oh,
yeah,
gosh.
Because everyone wants to stock up on their D batteries. And for some reason, strawberry Pop-Tarts.
Good. More fudge Pop-Tarts for me.
When people do this, there is a huge comfort component to it.
Yeah.
There is the idea, like, you know, being stuck at home could also seem kind of fun, and people are buying things that might, you know, the Pop-Tarts are definitely one of those, like, yeah, it's going to be fun. We'll have Pop-Tarts. I totally get that, like getting hunkered in. You know, when we had the tornado, Steve, what year was that? 2017?
Just 2 years ago.
A couple of years ago?
18.
Well, it was pretty bad, and I remember going to Home Depot, and I bought the last generator that they had, and it was at the point where people were walking around Home Depot and they looked dazed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They just didn't know what was happening. They didn't know what to do. And I really do agree. I mean, look, you know, you could always rotate through the stuff. This is the other thing about keeping food in storage. You know, like, let's say you keep 3 or 4 bottles of water. Like, my wife and I have a water dispenser, so it's like the big 5-gallon things of water. You could just rotate through those, like have 3 or 4 extra.
Yeah, always use the most, the oldest stuff.
One. Yeah, that's all. That's what we do. We just rotate through our food, but we just have more of it, you know, in backlog. We're not like, a lot of people have days of food, like, and if after 3 or 4 days, they're starving. You know what I mean? You shouldn't be in that situation.
But I don't get the toilet paper thing. Maybe it's because I like buy my toilet paper at Costco and I just put it in the pantry. But like, I can't imagine a time when I'm like, oh shit, I need 2 weeks of toilet paper that I don't have. Like, what, are you just going to shit a lot when you're stuck home? Like more than usual?
Well, because it's not perishable and they figure. Yeah.
Hey, I don't know about you, but if the apocalypse comes, I'm shitting in my pants.
Bob's going to be stocking up on large, extra large Huggies. Pampers.
All right. Bob, you're going to give us a segment of your numbers up. And this week, the number is a letter.
Ah, yes. You could say that. So, hello and welcome to Bob, Your Numbers Up. Today I'm talking about one of my favorite numbers, as I always do, the speed of light. The speed of light in a vacuum is 186,282 miles per second, or 299,792,458 meters per second, which of course is always rounded up to the beautiful 300,000 kilometers per second. It's so close. Everyone just says 300,000 kilometers.
Yeah, good, easy number to remember, 300K per second.
But for me, it's always, I always remember, like, I round down a little bit, 186,000 miles per second, because that's like when, you know, we didn't even know what metric was when I learned that number. But the meter is actually intimately related to the speed of light now, because the meter itself is defined internationally as the length of the path traveled by light in vacuum during a time interval of 1/299,792,458 of a second. So
why would they pick that?
Because you could create a meter anywhere on the planet. And you don't need to reference this specific meter stick that's sacrosanct and pristine. And it's kind of, you know, they're trying to get away from those types of things, like the kilogram. This is the master kilogram. They're trying to get away. They're trying to make these units into things that can be derived. And they did this, I think, way back in, it's been a little while, I think 80s maybe. So the speed of light is is used in probably the most famous equation of all time, Einstein's famous E equals mc squared. C, Steve alluded to the letter C. That's used for the speed of light in equations like this. And of course, that equation is so iconic. Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. And the big takeaway is that all you need is just a tiny bit of mass on one side of the equation, because you're multiplying it times the speed of light squared, and the other side of the equation is a lot of energy. Let's see. And Einstein, of course, is intimately associated with light for many reasons. His special relativity says that C is a maximum speed that matter and information can travel, and not just electromagnetic radiation. That applies to massless particles and gravitational waves as well. So there's so much you could focus on with light. I mean, you could literally talk for hours about it, but I want to focus on the number itself. How did it get to where it is? So measuring the speed of light, I mean, just a few hundred years ago, a lot of people, many, many scientists just assumed that light traveled infinitely fast. It's because it's so fast, you could easily confuse it with an infinite speed. Now, the first person to question this seems to be the 5th century BC philosopher Empedocles. He's the first one that said, I think it travels at a finite speed. Aristotle disagreed with him famously many decades later. And of course, the arguments went back and forth for a couple of millennia. But Empedocles was fascinated. He gets the credit for the first fleshed out theory of light and vision. But you may think it's kind of bizarre. Empedocles believed that light flowed from the eyes instead of the other way around. And that's right. And that seems really silly. Now, right, Jay, you guffawed, right? Is that a guffaw? Or is it a chortle?
It's more of a guffaw.
So it seems silly now, of course, but later Greek giants like Euclid would use Empedocles' ideas as the basis for their amazingly important theories of light, vision, and optics. So it did come in handy. And so being a little bit wrong can have huge benefits downstream.
Well, and it's kind of interesting that light actually kind of like bounces. So it enters your retina and then it goes through the cells backward, like from the back forward. Yeah. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Maybe a tiny bit right there.
Who designed that damn thing? So now the first person to propose an experiment to find that elusive number for the speed of light, who was the first person to propose an experiment, guys?
James Maxwell Clerk.
No. You may think Galileo, right?
No.
But no, Dutch scientist. Shut up, Steve. Dutch scientist Isaac Beeckman in 1629. His idea was to use an explosion to light mirrors at different distances to try to get a sense of how fast light was traveling. 10 years later, it was 10 years later that Galileo had his famous thought experiment. I think, you know, it's either a thought experiment or maybe he carried it out, but I think it was probably more of a thought experiment with on the hilltop with the lanterns, right? And you open and close them. But that was 10 years after Beeckman had his idea. But the bottom line for these was that they even if they were all performed pristinely with the best technology of the day, they none of them would be able to distinguish between a very fast speed for light or an infinite speed. Just you cannot use these distances between hills. It's kind of silly.
Here's a good visualization. I don't know if this helps or not, but a light nanosecond. So a nanosecond is 10^-9 seconds. How far does light go in a nanosecond? 0.3 meters.
Okay.
So a little bit less than a foot.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So you could see it. You know, it's like that's how far light would go in 1 nanosecond. So yeah, that's a little bit faster than a human reaction time.
Yeah. I always remember light travels around the Earth 7 times every second. So remember when Superman was flying around the Earth to turn time backwards, he was going boop, 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 really fast.
I remember when that happened.
Now, who was the first to get a serious number for the speed of light C? Now, this was Danish astronomer Ole Rømer in 1676. So his whole idea was the whole Jupiter-Io eclipse thing, where he noticed that Io was being eclipsed by Jupiter at various times during the year, but not when it was predicted. It was off. And it seemed to depend on where the Earth was and where Jupiter was in their respective orbits. So there's a maximum distance between Earth and Jupiter that they could possibly be, and there's a minimum distance, and that could impact. It's so the time the distances are so huge that it actually would be noticeable in terms of how the light having to cross that extra distance. So he did some experiments. So and he calculated 220,000 kilometers per second, and this figure is off. It's off by I think about by 27%.
That's correct within an order of magnitude.
But still, it's even better than that, right? But it's even better than that. And there was a universal, almost universal skepticism of Romer's colleagues, and no one was believing them. So Romer told them, "It's like, oh yeah, Io's 9th of November eclipse in 1676 is going to be 10 minutes late." So they were all watching, and they all shit in their pants because he was right. And at that point, you either become a believer or you're a denier. You're no longer a skeptic. That's pretty solid, you know, to see this guy predict that this is going to be 10 minutes late. And it was because he knew, relatively speaking, where Earth and Jupiter were in their orbits. And that number, even though it was off by 27% from the number that's accepted today, it is remarkably impressive given that the state of the science and technology at that time. And you could look at it another way. It's like it wasn't even Romer's fault at all because he was using other people's numbers for the size of the Earth and Jupiter's orbits, and they were off. Yeah. And that's why his calculations were off. So Romer totally rocks. I almost felt like skipping all the other people that contributed after that, because after that, it's just like refining. You know, it's just a refinement. And they just became increasingly accurate. But I'll mention a few names. So there was input from English astronomer James Bradley. He was looking at it from the position of like an angular variation in the incoming light. And then who can forget the contributions by those two French scientists who hated each other, Fizeau and Foucault, with their rotating mirror and toothed wheel ideas, which were also very, very accurate. But then you come to the real modern era using interferometers and cavity resonance techniques to become incredibly accurate, like the number we have today. And our current recognized value for the most important speed limit anywhere is 299,792,458 meters per second, derived by the U.S. National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado in 1972. That's the number. It's not going anywhere. And this was Bob, your number's up, and I hope you enjoyed it more than when your number's up.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Jay, you're going to start us off with the news items, but this is more of sort of a review of how planes fly, or more specifically, that we don't really know.
Oh, man, are we getting into that? Oh, boy.
Yeah,
you ready?
We're not just getting into that.
Oh,
we
Jesus.
Are getting into it, and I had to actually split this news item into two different episodes. So I couldn't finish the whole thing because I would be – it's a 15-minute discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to do is I will put all the premises out to everyone first, and then next week I'll give you what the latest and greatest actual answer is to the question. But
a two-parter news item.
This is one of those things, though. You think you know the answer, but you don't. What keeps planes aloft? What is lift?
Magic. It's the sky fairies.
Exactly.
See? Just attribute it to magic. Move along.
It certainly isn't that thing on the wing, right? Like from a...
nice, Chatner.
That is the exact opposite of flight. That is a nightmare in an airplane. Oh, my God. If I ever saw that, you just shoot me in the back of the head immediately. So 20 years ago, the curator of aerodynamics at National Air and Space Museum and an author of multiple books about aerodynamics, John D. Anderson Jr., gave a very interesting response when asked the question, what is lift? And his response was, there's two ways to think about it. There isn't really one answer. And it's a very complicated question without an actual answer. We don't really, really, really have it 100% dialed like we have so many other things. Now, we can get close, but listen to this. So the experts in the field don't completely agree. There is some dissent among the experts, and no one is really 100% right or wrong. Here are some of the ways to think about this. There are two basic ways to think about the question. First, we can explain what lift is technically using math, right? So no one's disagreeing about what the current mathematical equations that we use to design new aircraft. No one's arguing about what math gives the best results and what is accurate, meaning you know, they can design an airplane using these mathematical equations on how the aerodynamics of a wing is going to operate.
And then the airplane flies.
And then the airplane flies. So it correctly describes the forces, but that's it. The technical information behind lift doesn't actually answer the initial question of what is lift? Where does lift actually come from? The technical information is just an explanation of the effect, okay? The second way to think about this is a non-technical explanation. So you could think of this more like a real-world description of what forces are at play and the basic concepts and principles that non-experts can understand. And this is where, you know, if you're not, if you don't have your doctorate in aerodynamics, you know, if you're someone like us, you're a non-expert and you're going to talk about it in very pedestrian terms. But that's the way we need to also think about how lift is generated, because that gives us really almost a better understanding of where it comes from. It is in this non-technical explanation where the experts disagree, right? So to make this perfectly clear, nobody is disagreeing about what the math is behind predicting the behavior of aerodynamics. It's all about the description of aerodynamics and how it actually comes into being. So there's two different theories that explain how lift works. The first one is, and the most common, is this accepted theory called Bernoulli's theorem. In 1738, Daniel Bernoulli published a treatise called Hydrodynamica, and this was about fluid dynamics. Now, this pertains to air because air is also a fluid. So his theories and what he had in that publication did pretty accurately describe the way that air would function as well. Now, his law states that pressure of a fluid decreases as its velocity increases and vice versa. Now, this goes back to what most of us learned in school about how, you know, the curved upper part of a wing or the curved upper surface of a wing or an airfoil causes lift. And the basic concept is that the air is moving over the top of the curved part of the airfoil. And because it's curved, it ends up moving faster than the air that is moving under the flat part of the wing, which typically the curved part is on top and the flat part is on the bottom of an airfoil. Now, since the air that is going over the curved part of the wing is moving faster, it creates an area of lower pressure, which we call lift. Right, guys? Didn't we learn this in school? There is a vast amount of laboratory tests that prove that this is happening. We can see it. We can see it happening. It shows exactly how Bernoulli's theorem works. Now, what we can prove in the laboratory is that the air that's moving on top of the curved part of an airfoil indeed does move faster than the air that's going underneath the wing, the flat part of the wing. The problem is that Bernoulli's theorem does not explain why the air actually is moving faster over the top part of the wing. Again, it's predictive. We can predict the behavior, but it's not explaining the physics behind why it's actually taking place.
And also, Jay, related to that, it doesn't necessarily explain why a plane that is upside down could also maintain lift, or a flat-winged wings, well, like a glider, like a you throw. How does that have lift where there's no curve?
Bob, like the mathematical equation, you were very predictive in your response to what I said. Yes, Bob, you're totally right. This was the very next thing I was going to say. There's missing pieces of information in Bernoulli's theorem. Okay. It doesn't state how the higher velocity air causes lower pressure. Also, an airfoil, like Bob said, can be inverted and still provide lift. And this is why planes that fly upside down can still fly. Right? I mean, we've seen planes fly upside down on YouTube a million times. I've seen them at air shows. They can fly upside down. And you know, most wings do have that, the flat bottom part of the wing and the upper curve part. But check this out. Did you know that you can have a wing function perfectly well that's teardrop shaped? It has two curved surfaces on the wing. How about that?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Okay.
So the second theory of lift comes from Newton's third law of motion. This third law states, anybody, that for every
action
opposite
reaction.
Equal reaction.
I love all y'all. So simply put, the airfoil is pushing air down towards the ground, which then would push the airplane up. The logical reaction to air being forced down as it goes over the airfoil would logically push the plane in the opposite direction, which is up. Hopefully, right? Up. Mm-hmm. So you could do this by putting your hand outside of a moving car and use it as an airfoil, right? Everybody's done this as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you angle your hand up. You know, you just tilt your pinky down and your pointer finger goes up a little bit and your hand wants to go up. What's happening is it's reflecting the air that's hitting your hand down, and that downward force is pushing your hand up, right? Simple. Newton's third law actually seems a little more intuitive now that I've described it that way than Bernoulli's theorem, doesn't it? You say, well, yeah, okay, that makes more sense. Air is being pushed down, and it's pushing the air up. But the obvious problem with this explanation is that it doesn't explain the lower pressure that is found on the curved part of an airfoil. So guys, next week I'm going to explain how modern aerodynamics actually digs into the details about what actually is going on. And I'm telling you now, get ready, because it's really cool and it's way more complicated than you think. There's multiple things happening at the same time. It's funny, many people have described it, you know, this is for theatrics, but they're saying it's almost magical how these different components together create lift. But any one of them.
Magic.
Yeah. But, you know, meaning that it's complicated because physics is amazingly complicated. I will continue next week. Steve, I know you're excited.
I can't wait. This reminds me of the discussion we had about, like, why do bicycles stay up when the wheel is turning?
And oh, boy.
Right. It's just as counterintuitive and complicated. Or how do bumblebees fly? Right.
Yeah. Now, you know what blew my mind when I was learning to ride a motorcycle in the old days? It was nuts. And I don't know why anybody that loved me let me get on a motorcycle. But they have something called counter turning or counter steering. And you know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you're on a motorcycle, when you're turning, you're leaning a certain amount into the turn. Right. You don't really turn the wheel the way you think. You actually turn the wheel in the opposite direction. You steer the motorcycle when you're at speed.
The wrong way?
Yeah, just a tiny bit.
Oh, when you're
bit.
At speed.
When you're at speed.
To keep you from falling over?
Kara,
to maintain equilibrium.
I don't get it. I don't understand.
That's amazing.
It's
sort of weirdly related, but did I tell you guys about a few episodes ago on Brain Games was like the kids versus adult episode.
Yeah, and driving the go-karts.
Yeah, and we rigged the go-karts to go the wrong way when you turn the steering column.
Oh, yeah.
So how long did it take to get used to it?
So here's the crazy thing. We pitted kids versus adults on this like go-kart course with all these obstacles. And, you know, their parents kicked their asses. Like, kids suck at riding go-karts because they don't know how to drive. But their parents were really good at it. And then we gave them the reversed cars.
And the kids did better.
Oh, my gosh. Kids just owned their parents. Like, kids on average would add like 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds to their course when their steering was reversed. And parents would add like 4 minutes. They would just like keep crashing over and over.
Parents
and over.
Are fixed in their ways.
Totally,
kids
yeah.
Kids are more malleable.
Well, and kids have never driven. So like they have
to unlearn. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, but it was pretty, I mean, incredible to watch how bad we are at driving when our steering is reversed.
I know, I hate it. For some reason, I hate
when that happens.
I always play video games with the mouse inverted in terms of looking up and looking down.
Turn off.
But like Jay plays it the incorrect way.
The wrong way.
Jay, no way you do.
So whenever
you don't invert your Y axis.
I'll tell you why. Because that's the way the stick in an airplane works. It's because I used to
Are
play.
Are you sure about that?
I used to play a lot of flight simulator games, and I got used to when I wanted to go down, I would push the stick forward, and when I wanted to go up, I'd pull the stick up, pull the stick back.
Yeah, but that's the inverted mouse, Jay. What you're describing?
Yeah, I use the mouse inverted, Steve.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
No, I do. And when I
no,
jump on,
I
like,
do.
You do it the opposite way that I do. So what I like, if you're playing a game and I get jump on to play, and it's backwards from what I'm used to, it totally screws me up. I cannot reverse those instincts.
When people have laptops, I don't know, Mac laptops, you use a two-finger swipe and it like scrolls you up or down. Mm-hmm. But I guess mice are the same way, right? You either turn the wheel down or up. And I do what they call reverse, whereas other people do what they call natural, which is when I scroll my fingers down, the screen goes down. Whereas other people, when they scroll down, the screen goes up.
Yeah, and the mouse goes
crazy.
Down.
Yeah, I don't know. Why would you do that? It feels wrong.
Because you're controlling the mouse, not the screen.
Yes, you are. You're controlling the screen.
No, you're wrong. But whatever you get used to, it's very, very hard.
Yeah, the other one is wrong. Oh,
very, it's very hard to reverse those.
Jay's two-part news item is about to turn into a three-part news item.
All right. I love it.
Well, let's get to something completely different. I know you guys have heard of binaural beats. Any of you guys remember what those are?
Yeah.
Binaural is like when it's recorded to be like left versus right.
This is a real thing that has been co-opted by pseudoscientists. But here's the real thing. If you listen to slightly different frequencies in each ear, right? So your right ear gets one frequency, your left ear gets a slightly different frequency. That causes an auditory illusion, right? It's something that's just happening in the brain with processing, where you hear a third tone that oscillates, that hence the beat. Right? So you have like a pulsating third tone, but it's completely illusory. Now, if you play two frequencies that are slightly off from each other, where both ears are hearing both frequencies, that will cause a physical third tone sometimes, depending on the conditions and the tones. Right?
But like that other people can measure too.
That's real. It's a physical creation of it. It has to do with the constructive and destructive interference of the waves. But that's not what we're talking about with binaural beats. We're talking about an illusory sound that only occurs in your brain. It's not out there in the real world physically.
Why? That makes sense. Why does your brain want to do that?
It's like it's like an illusion, right? It's like a visual illusion, but
yeah, it doesn't want to. Yeah, it's just an epiphenomenon of how your brain processes audio, which is complicated, and we don't understand it nearly as well as we understand the visual system. We understand a lot more about how the brain processes vision than how it processes sound.
Why is that, Steve?
It's more complicated. It's a lot more complicated.
I also think it was just early. I mean, yes, it is more complicated. And it's also what a lot of early psychologists and neuroscientists studied was visual illusions. It's just where the research was.
Yeah, it may be an artifact of that, but I think it's also that it's lower hanging fruit.
Yeah,
even now that we are studying the auditory system, it's like, shit, this is complicated. Like we don't know really what causes tinnitus, that pathological ringing that you might hear in one or both ears.
I have it. Yep, I have tinnitus.
That sucks.
I have it too. Don't know.
But it's not it's not debilitating. It doesn't interfere with my day to day.
Not yet.
Background all the time.
But
I know
for some people it's bound. Yeah.
It will likely get worse, I would think, as I get older.
Yeah, but you learn to ignore it.
Right.
So people claim that these binaural beats are, and I hate this, a way of hacking into the brain.
Brain
hack that can do all kinds of things, whatever you want it to do, right? Mainly, the couple things, mainly affecting mood, like calming you down, improving your mood, treating depression, treating anxiety, and then also improve memory and alertness.
Now, just from like playing a sound?
Right. So, that's sort of my default is whenever I hear about any brain hack, it's like, okay, it's probably not true, but let's look at the evidence. So what prompted this news item was a study that is looking at the effect of binaural beats on mood. And they did a very interesting experiment where they had, they created binaural beats in the normal way by, using stereo with the different ears hearing different frequencies. But then what they did was they basically recorded what the binaural beats sound like, right? And then played that into both ears. You're basically hearing the same thing, but in the first condition, your brain is generating an auditory illusion. And in the second condition, you're just hearing sounds that are actually being played into your ears. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like a control?
Yeah. That was the control. Exactly.
Okay.
So it's exact same sort of sensory, superficial experience, but what's happening in the brain is decidedly different. So then they looked at, okay, what's happening in the brain and does this have any effect on mood? Of course, this was mostly self-report, the mood part. But what this new study found was between those two conditions, there was no significant difference. So they basically said there was no effect on mood in this study from the binaural beats versus this pretty ingenious control, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I was looking into that, and like, of course, that sort of fits my bias. Like, yeah, of course it doesn't work. It's too simple. It's too easy. It's a brain hack. But I said, but let's go in. But the authors made mention in the study of, they didn't look at the effect on memory and alertness, and the data does support that. I'm like, okay, interesting. So they're saying that there is some data to support. So I decided to check it out for myself. So there was a 2019 meta-analysis. So that's the most recent meta-analysis that I could find that was published. And this is what the authors conclude in that meta-analysis. This is looking at binaural beats from memory or cognition, not for mood. Ready? They write, our meta-analysis adds to the growing evidence that binaural beat exposure is an effective way to affect cognition over and above reducing anxiety levels and the perception of pain without prior training, and that the direction and the magnitude of the effect depends upon the frequency used, time under exposure, and the moment in which the exposure takes place. So, again, they're finding some effect, and they're finding some pattern to the effect. And what they're talking about is the frequency of this third perceived illusory beat. And in the 15 to 20 hertz range, it seems to have had a positive effect on memory. In the 5 to 10 hertz range, it had a negative effect on memory.
Weird.
Now, that's weird. Then also, but when you see things like that, you know, when I see things like that, I'm thinking, okay, is this just statistical noise? You
know? I know. My first question is, what the hell is the mechanism?
Right. But multiple studies showed the same pattern. So it's not just random statistical noise. It does appear that the higher frequency binaural beats do have a differential effect on alertness, at least. And then maybe that alertness is what's having people perform better on memory tests, which is what I suspect. Yeah. So, and also, you know, the big caveat is most of these studies are small and preliminary, you know, so I do think that we're seeing an interesting signal in this research, but it needs to be fully confirmed with more rigorous, larger trials that are well controlled before I buy it. So I don't buy it yet, but the preliminary evidence is positive and there is this very interesting pattern. It's kind of like a dose response curve where it's not just that there's an effect there, there's a dose response effect. So it makes the data more believable. So I do think that the fact that there's this consistency, at least between two or more studies showing that the higher frequencies are the only frequencies with a positive effect, does make the data a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, I guess the question is that in those studies where you did see this effect that was consistent, did they also use sort of this like ingenious control group?
No, so they didn't. So that's the thing. They were just
preliminary
studies.
Yeah, so the thing is maybe it's just that.
Yeah, that but then why noise? The frequency difference? But then why the frequency difference?
Well, because difference? Like a louder noise or a higher noise might have more of an effect than a lower noise or a quieter noise. And
yeah.
It has nothing to do with it being binaural.
So
it's
why?
But
why?
It's noise.
Yeah, but it's not as obvious that the frequency would make a difference. Loudness, yes, you know, but the frequency is not as intuitive.
But yeah, pitch. I don't know. I think. Yeah.
It's but yeah. These are all good questions. We don't have the answer to these questions, but these are all good questions. And this is what a skeptical scientist should ask: is it really some kind of effect on the brain, or is it more just a differential effect on how alert? Maybe the 15 hertz noise is more annoying. You
exactly.
know?
That's what I'm thinking. Like maybe just certain noises make you more alert.
I know that that's true for me. I've noticed that since I was a young child. I have memories of like certain frequencies have a very different effect on my attention than other frequencies. And that has persisted into my adulthood. I don't know if everybody has that. What the researchers speculate is that this is borne out by some studies where they look at like brain activity. That when the illusion occurs, when the binaural beat illusion occurs, there is this increase in crosstalk between different parts of the brain, which of course kind of makes sense because it is the two parts of the brain, you know, two sides of the brain have to be communicating with each other in order. It's like, you know, it is a neurological stereo effect, right? The signals have to be interfering with each other neurologically in order to create this illusory sound. So from one point of view, of course that's happening. But again, it does seem to be happening more at the higher frequencies than at the lower frequencies, and that seems to correlate with the improvement in memory. The effect size is also was described as medium. It's like a medium effect size. So it's not dramatic, but not tiny either. So again, not convincing, but plausible, I guess I would say.
But it could also show that there are individual differences, just like there are physically with like depth perception of the eyes.
Yeah, exactly. So I imagine there's going to be a lot of individual differences. And this is always sort of my big thing whenever someone is claiming that there's some new, you know, biological effect is this a specific effect or a non-specific effect, right? So is it like acupuncture where I think there's a non-specific therapeutic intervention effect? There isn't a specific effect of sticking needles in non-existent acupuncture points. Or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR. I don't think there's a specific effect to it. I think there's a non-specific effect of introducing a novel element into the therapy session and maybe distraction. That's all it is. But any kind of distraction would do just as well. I'm also not convinced that meditation has a specific effect. It could be beyond relaxation. And I don't think that the studies have been designed well enough to separate those two things. So I want to see studies that separate a specific neurological effect here from just this sound is annoying me and it's drawing my attention, or it's just like caffeine. It's just making me, my brain a little bit more activated because like there's this stimulating kind of thing happening, right? Or is it really doing something in terms of affecting the way the brain is processing information, et cetera? So I'm always very skeptical of those more specific claims about, you know, some kind of hack effect versus you. I think you have to rule out the non-specific effects before you jump to a claim for some specific new neurological phenomenon.
Definitely. But I will say that, and this is a whole other conversation that we could open into, I actually wrote a paper recently for one of my like biological psychology courses about meditation, very specifically about like the introspective part of meditation, like not so much because there's different types of meditation, so it's really hard. I'm not talking about like transcendental meditation or anything, but I'm just talking about mindfulness, this idea of like focusing on the breath and returning constantly to an anchor. And there do seem to be massive differences in that type of meditation on the default mode network than there are in just relaxing. Because when you relax, your mind wanders. And when you meditate, you redirect your attention over and over and over. And that seems to be the difference. So there are some neurological differences. But in terms of outcomes, that's a different conversation.
However, so I'm largely also going on a review that was published about a year ago. I think we talked about it on the show, by researchers involved in meditation research, who basically said, combing through the research, it's not a consistent construct. We don't even really define what it is. So how could we really study it in detail?
That's the problem, is that that's some people throw different types of meditation into one thing. And what we find is that just like maybe with this binaural thing, certain types of meditation where you're allowed to allow your mind to wander, or you're focused on an outward thing instead of an inward thing, actually have different effects on your default mode network. So you really have to define what it is you're doing and then do it over and over and over.
Yeah, so I'm kind of
a clean result.
I'm kind of reserving judgment on the whole meditation thing until we get bit more, you know, consistent constructs that we can study in detail. I think right now it's just like I don't really know what to make of the research.
But yeah, the good news is it's pretty hot, so that people are studying it left and right. So there's a lot of studies coming out.
It's a lot of crappy studies. Yeah.
Steve, would you say though, that we're sure though that there's nothing to binaural beats?
No, I'm not saying that we're not sure. I'm not sure there's nothing to it. What I'm saying
sounds
is
like there might be something.
I was actually surprised. There was more there than I thought there was going to be, and there are some interesting aspects to it. But it clearly needs some rigorous, you know, study design.
Yeah, much
and
more
and the
deeper.
Most recent study, which was just looking at the effect on mood, was negative, and that had a really good control. So that isn't a good sign, at least for the mood claims. But some kind of alerting memory effect, that's not out of the realm of possibility. The preliminary evidence is encouraging, but we're not at the point yet where I would conclude it's a done deal. All right, Kara.
Yes.
Tell us about this non-breathing animal I'm hearing all about.
Yeah, this is really, really cool. Okay, so it's a parasite. It does fall within the animal kingdom, and it is called Henegoia salminicola. I have no idea if I'm saying that right.
That's pretty good.
H. salminicola. And according to a study that was just published in PNAS, this...
So funny.
I know. This cnidarian parasite that tends to infect salmon is really weird, and it has all these super cool features. Number one, it's the only known animal on Earth so far, I should probably caveat that doesn't breathe. And number two, the reason they know it doesn't breathe is because it doesn't even have the genes to encode for respiration because it's lacking mitochondrial DNA.
Whoa.
Right.
Which is weird. So we know that there are organisms that are anaerobic, and we know that there are organisms that are lacking mitochondrial DNA, but those organisms aren't animals. They're almost exclusively unicellular. They're almost exclusively not eukaryotes, but prokaryotes. So it's really interesting that we're seeing a eukaryotic and even an advanced eukaryotic, quote unquote advanced, an animal, something falling under that kingdom, that does have MROs, mitochondria-related organelles.
Holy crap. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And here's the really cool thing. Da-da-da-da-da. They don't think that it's because they have not yet evolved them. They think it's that they evolved them and then, like, devolved them, meaning that they lost them, yes, as they became more and more adapted to their environment, which was a low oxygen or no oxygen parasitic environment, this hypoxic environment within the salmon where they fully infected and are, you know, their life cycle is existing inside of a larger organism, that they lost things like major tissues, they lost things like muscles, they lost their, or they changed their mitochondria, and they lost the portion of the genome that would code for transcribing and replicating the mitochondrial genome. So that's within the nucleus, they lost those genes. And in doing so, they lost the genes within the mitochondria that would be involved in aerobic respiration. So they said that these things that are typically found in other organisms are either completely absent in these cnidarians, they're of the myxozoan group, that they're either completely absent or they're present only as what they call pseudogenes.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually did a really interesting study where they made fluorescence micrographs of both this organism that I was talking about, H. salminicola, which is a cnidarian that's like sort of very distantly related to hydra and to jellyfish.
Mm-hmm.
They compared them to M. squamalis, which is a closely related myxozoan, obviously not the same genus though. And they found that they were able to see the mitochondrial genome within M. squamalis, but that the mitochondrial genome was wholly lacking in H. salminicola.
Yeah.
So their question for how this happened, they don't know. Their question for what it does encode, you know, what it can it do, what can't it do. These are all questions that remain. Exactly how does it even like acquire energy if it doesn't breathe? They don't know, but they do know that in other parasites, they've been able to see that they can take ATP from their hosts.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of like import this molecule that's necessary for making energy. And
that's how they deal. That's how they get their ATP.
Yeah.
They steal it.
They just steal it.
Screw that,
anyway.
Man. Don't steal my ATP.
You'll make more, Bob. Don't worry.
So they don't know yet if that's how this organism does it, but they have that. That has precedent. They've seen it in other organisms, so that is like a working hypothesis that they need to discover more. And these things are cool looking. Like they almost look like sperm.
Yeah.
They have a little tail, and they have what look like eye spots, but they're actually not eye spots. They call them stinger cells, but they don't sting. They don't have venom in them. They're actually helpful for these parasites to latch onto their host when they need to. And then, yeah, it's often called tapioca disease, these salmon that have this parasite within them, because once they multiply, they will like burst out of the fish, out of the flesh of the fish, and they look like these big blobs like tapioca. Apparently, it's grouping, its family is pretty horrific. This one seems to be benign, but there are parasites that are related to it that have wiped out like whole fisheries.
Jeez.
That's terrible. Yeah. But that is not uncommon. I mean, I remember reading about this. Stephen Jay Gould wrote about it in the 1980s, that the parasites have selective pressure to become simpler over time.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
so
it's super interesting.
they lose entire, you know, organs, you know, and sets of genes and stuff.
Because why keep them? It's a massive waste of energy.
Right. Right.
Yes.
You don't want to keep stuff around that you don't need, because just it costs energy. It's something that could get diseased itself, that could go wrong.
Breathing's overrated.
Thank you, Kara.
For them, it is.
I love breathing.
Evan, so this is tragic news, but we have to talk about it. Self-proclaimed rocket man, Mad Mike Hughes, met an untimely end this past week.
Mike Hughes, Daredevil, Mad Mike, he was called. and he died this past Saturday in California aboard a steam-powered rocket that he designed and built on his own. 64 years old he was, and he went out the way so few others have ever gone.
Yeah.
On the back of a rocket. I mean, who can, you know, I mean, if you're going to go, that's a big way to go. Now, we might be tempted to call him Mad Mike because of some of his conspiratorial views he's expressed over many years. Perhaps none more headline-grabbing than Flat Earth. Yep, he was a self-proclaimed Flat Earther. But behind the veneer of controversy that comes with the territory of people who believe that they live on a Flat Earth, Mad Mike was really kind of something else. He was a, well, self-promoter. You know, he tried to develop his own brand, sort of like Evel Knievel was more of a brand back in the day, even more than he was just a man. He strived for notoriety, Mad Mike did. And in the world of daredeviling, taking life and limb chances gets you so far, but you have to become something else in order to stand out above everyone else. So understanding Mad Mike's backstory is a little bit important here. So here are the takeaways. His daring life of speed began in 1974 when he became a professional motorcycle racer. And according to his biography, he became the top ice speedway motorcycle racer in the United States by the year 1979. No doubt that it's some kind of cherished title in the world of motorcycle racing. I'm going to have to take them at their word on that one. It continued into the 1980s, where Hughes moved into automotives. He worked as a fabricator and a body specialist on cars for NASCAR drivers, Randy LaGioia and Rob Moroso, to name a few. He was a crew chief for Craftsman truck teams in Washington State. But by 1994, he moved to Las Vegas, and he became both a limousine chauffeur and a daredevil. And he took to referring to himself as the world's most famous limo driver. Now, why was he the world's most famous limo driver? Well, because in 2002, he achieved some obscure level of success and fame when he set a Guinness World Record for the longest limousine ramp jump. Yep, he jumped a limousine off a ramp 103 feet in the air in a Lincoln Town Car in a stretch limousine. Wow, world record, right? Well, we might be expected to ignore the fact that before the jump, no such category had really existed.
Yeah, right.
But he reached out to the Guinness record keepers to ask if they would be interested, and they came to an agreement. And yes, they decided that if he could do this, he would get into the record books. So again, you know, kind of promoting himself in a sense. He published a book in 2007 called What Does a Limo Driver Know About NASCAR? More self-promotion. Now, after his limo driving and limo jumping days were over, Mad Mike set his sights upward by building his own rocket vehicle, which he did, and he called it the X2 Sky Limo. It was his first crewed rocket. He flew aboard it. On January 30, 2014, this took place in Arizona. He reached a peak altitude of 1,374 feet, or roughly 419 meters. And the flight took about 1 minute. Now, supposedly, the landing was extremely rough, and he needed many weeks to recover from undisclosed injuries. That is as the reports go. But at this point of his career, 2014, he began to express thoughts about a flat Earth.
Yep.
In a 2017 documentary about him entitled Rocket Man, Mad Mike's Mission to Prove the Flat Earth, Hughes himself stated that, "I'm not going to take anyone else's word for it, or NASA, or especially Elon Musk with SpaceX. I'm going to build my own rocket right here, and I'm going to see it with my own eyes what shape this world we live on." And he's also said some other sort of provocative things, such as in 2018, he was doing an interview with Associated Press, and he said, "I don't believe in science. I know about aerodynamics and fluid dynamics and how things move through the air, about the certain size of rocket nozzles and thrust, but that's not science. That's just a formula. There's no difference." God. He said there's no difference between science and science fiction.
What? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
He was a kook.
That sounds like showboarding to me.
That's just words.
Sounds more like showboarding. I mean, if he really understood aerodynamics and things like that, you'd think he'd have some marginal appreciation for like what it took to understand it.
Yeah, but there is, I think there is like a type of cognitive dissonance where you can be really interested in engineering, but not really understand the scientific method.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But I, you know, my sense of him is that he was a daredevil first and a flat earther second. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much that was just marketing for him. I mean, we don't know. I mean, like, I wonder what people close to him really thought. Did he just say, hey, I could, you know, tie into the flat earther community. They'll donate to my rocket, you know, plans, and I'll do it under the guise of, you know, I'm going to see the shape of the earth for myself. But like his rocket enthusiasm predated his flat eartherism.
Yeah, and it doesn't really like compute that well how blasting yourself off in a rocket is going to help a flat earther cause. My question is, did he think he was going to land?
Yeah, like, so what was supposed to happen was when he got to his apex, no, a balloon was going to deploy and carry him even higher in altitude so he can get high enough to see the shape of the earth. The balloon never deployed. And so he just crashed out.
Yeah. It was violent. I mean, he was up really high.
Yeah.
The rocket worked. I mean, it's pretty cool that he built a functional rocket. It's just, you know, probably would have tested it first without.
Well, this was not his first test of that rocket.
No, it wasn't. No, he had a successful test of the rocket in 2018.
With the balloon.
You know what? I don't know that one had the balloon.
That was kind of the important part.
Yeah, but he did. But he did. In 18, he launched himself about 1,900 feet into the air. And this was the rocket that had the flat earth on the side of it. I think we talked about it on the show. I recall Jay actually, I think, doing a news item about that.
And this guy also reminds me of Troy Herdebice. Remember that guy? Mm-mm. So he was the guy who invented the Ursus Mark VI anti-bear suit.
Oh my god, I love that guy. That was so
bear suit.
He was also kind of a kook. Cool. He had the angel light. He said he could see through walls. That was nonsense.
Yeah.
He died in 2018 in a car accident on a highway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The fact that that guy didn't die by bear blows my mind.
Yeah, he survived his bear suit experiments. But that's what, you know, that's the life of a daredevil. You know, Mike Hughes didn't survive his rocket man endeavors. But I think whenever you live that way, that you kind of expect that this is eventually going to happen. Like if you're a daredevil, you're probably going to die in a crash.
Yeah. Even if you do something that takes on a certain amount of bodily, you know, risk of bodily harm. Yeah. Like if you guys watch the Alex Honnold documentary.
Free Solo.
Thank you.
That was awesome.
Yeah. He's very explicit in it that like I could totally die doing this. Like all my friends have died. Like, this is just a part of it.
Right. Yeah that right. is the
and the thing is, if you do die doing it, which is horrible, there is, I don't know, there's some sort of kind of existential, like, I don't know what to call it, but it's like he died doing what he absolutely loved.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And he did admit, he said, it's about a 50-50 shot of me surviving every time I do this. So he had no illusions. That, you know, he was going to
his number was going to come up one
unscathed.
Time.
Yeah.
I read one newspaper, you know, editorial wrote that he was killed by flat eartherism. I'm like, no, he wasn't. He was a daredevil. No. That was just cosmetic.
Yeah.
And it's not because of his flat eartherism that he miscalculated something with his rocket. Yeah, that's why things went wrong. He obviously understood the engineering. He built a function.
Oh, yeah, but it was more like what a waste that he died in the pursuit of flat eartherism. But I don't think that was what he was in pursuit of. I think that was incidental.
Not to be selfish here and not to be cold, but I really did want the guy to succeed because I wanted him to come back and go, hey, you know, hey,
the earth was round. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
NASA got to him.
He probably wouldn't have, though.
Well,
that,
he said that if he was up there and he did see a round ball or an earth, that he would come down and say, yes, I was wrong. That's what he said.
But now, he wasn't going high enough to really see that.
No, not in these test flights.
He would
have
building
up to a much larger.
If the balloon had worked.
But wouldn't he have like lost consciousness up there?
Right, yeah. Where was his oxygen and all this?
You can't just like fly in a weather balloon.
Froze, you know? I mean, all this. How about this for a wrap up, those guys? I don't know if you saw this. He had a publicist. The publicist's name is Darren Schuster, and he told Vice in an interview just recently. He said, as his PR rep for 17 years, as Mike Hughes' PR rep for 17 years and privy to hundreds of hours one-on-one, I can say with certainty he was a great American daredevil. While open to the idea of government conspiracies, he was a daredevil who used Flat Earth publicly to get worldwide attention. It was a PR stunt.
Whoa!
Interesting.
Okay, his so that's what I was saying.
That. Yeah, and that's his publicist saying that just a few days ago.
All right. Interesting. Bias confirmed. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yep.
Jay, we haven't had a Who's That Noisy in a while. Get us up to speed.
Okay, guys. Last week, I played this noisy.
Is that a child screaming and a parrot trying to imitate the child?
It sounds like a French bulldog.
Oh, Evan, so many people guessed that. But that's not correct.
Did anybody guess French bulldog?
This one, no. Nobody came up with French bulldog.
Canadian bulldog?
There was a few classes of answers here. One was people were just saying the funniest thing they could possibly come up with that was creating the noise.
Why not?
Thank you. Those were fun. And the others were variations on a similar theme of a child and some type of animal. So Rick Richardson said, Jay, long time, first time I'll be attending both of the Seattle shows with my 13-year-old son, Ryder. Oh, yeah, we met Rick.
Oh,
Rick
yeah?
Richardson. Yeah, we met him. I remember
Hi, Rick.
Ryder. My guess is a dolphin making the noise for their trainer or the noise of the new planter peanut baby makes. So, Rick, you are not correct. But sure, I could see a dolphin making some of those noises in there. Next listener named Jim Kelly. Hi, I think this week's noisy is the sound of a toddler and a bird, such as a crane, meeting and greeting each other at the zoo. Incorrect and widely guessed by everyone, including Evan.
Yeah.
But the winner for last week was Caleb. And Caleb said, hey, Jay, continuing with the weekly guesses, sounds like a lovely duet between a toddler and a dog. The little girl is shrieking and the dog is vocalizing and trying to copy her, which makes her even more excited. Positive feedback loop. And this happens to be an Alaskan Husky. Now listen to it again.
Aww.
So if you've ever been super around cute. A husky or owned a husky, that's a pretty husky sound there.
Mm-hmm.
I totally recognize it the first time. I love, though, the reason why I play this one is funny, you know, and I just love funny dog noises. La la la. I'll never not be probably the best noisy of all time. but the dog and the little girl are just totally enjoying each other, and I love seeing people have relationships with animals, like real relationships. So that's why I played it. I just thought it was too adorable to pass up. So that was originally sent in by Matt. Thank you, Matt. That was a lot of fun. I have a new noisy for this week. All right, guys, I have a new noisy this week. I'm going to give you a quickie disclaimer. First off, when I play it, it is a little shrieky. So you will consider this a loud and irritating noise, very likely. And people had asked me to do it, so here it is. I'm doing it. The second thing is, this is a sound that many of you, I'll guarantee you that many of you have heard this sound, but this version of it has been manipulated. There is your hint. Here is the sound. All right, so there it is. Now listen, I warned you. I said it was going to be shrieky. Don't email me complaining, because I did give you a warning. You're supposed to turn your volume down when I say that. Send me questions, answers, and great ideas for noisies next week at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. Time for just a couple of quick emails. First one is a sort of correction from the science or fiction from Seattle. Although it's not, I don't think it's really a correction. It's about the Seahawk. There's just a more nuance to that.
Yeah.
So I remember I said there's no such bird as a Seahawk, The live mascot is an auger hawk, which is from Africa, and the costume mascot is a non-existent bird with colors that were cultural and not derived from any actual animal. Several people pointed out that the seahawk is a nickname for an osprey or a skua. So here's the thing. It's not an official or recognized name. It's not a common name. It's not an official name. It's just a completely unofficial nickname, the seahawk. It's also a two words. The nickname, the unofficial nickname for an osprey is a seahawk, not a seahawk. Mm. So it's accurate to say that the seahawk is not a real bird and doesn't exist. But yes, you could get confused by that. There's a lot of confusion as to why the Seattle Seahawks don't use an osprey as their mascot if an osprey's nickname is Seahawk. So first of all, their mascot is not an osprey, right?
Right.
But it's also illegal to have an osprey in captivity, so that would put a kibosh on that in any case.
Well, wait, why couldn't they have it as their mascot and just not have one?
You mean like as the fake bird that's the person in costume?
Because their mascot is not an osprey that they call by its nickname Seahawk. It's a non-existent fake bird, the Seahawk, right?
That they specifically made up and added indigenous colors.
To sow confusion.
Right. Yeah.
I know, but there is that wrinkle to it. And it wouldn't have affected the outcome of the game anyway because nobody on the panel voted for it. Okay. So we got a lot of feedback on our SGU 2035 episode.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to make so most of it was very positive and thank you.
Hate it, love it.
A few people, didn't get it, and didn't like it. And all of them, interestingly, every single one of them said they stopped listening after like 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
Yeah, fascinating.
Oh, the people who gave the negative.
Right.
They didn't really give it a chance. And some of the negative feedback was like, you're predicting the future. It's like, no, we're not. No. We're not really. That wasn't what it was about. It wasn't about predicting the future like a psychic.
Right.
So the episode, if you didn't hear it, I think it was actually one of my favorite episodes to record. We pretended like we were recording the episode in 2035, and it was structured as we took big topics that we deal with, and we gave the history of that, like GMOs, opposition, right? And of course, we gave the real history up until 2020, and then we speculated as to what the next 15 years would be like. So it was just sort of extrapolating big skeptical issues into a little bit, like what might lie ahead for those issues. So it was kind of a fun way to do it as like role playing. We were doing an episode from 2035. A lot of people commented on how awesome our role playing was. Thank you.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Can I interject with something real quick?
Go right ahead.
I got an email. You remember our favorite girl, Lola?
Yes.
She was on the show with us.
Yes, yes.
She sent an email. Hey, I just listened to the SGU episode about 2035. It's very comforting to know that you'll be on the SGU for at least another 15 years. Yeah. I can't wait till the Og comes out. Then I can have rainbow hair without having to dye it or take care of it. I love this. It does sound a bit dangerous, though. I would hope that no one virtually murders me. That would be horrible, and I would lose all my Minecraft worlds, lol. And you know, in 2035, your voice hasn't changed a bit. You don't sound a day over 36, winky face. In 2035, I'll be 28. Seems so far away, but it's only 15 years. This episode sounded so real. How did y'all remember everything to say? I loved how when Jay says the mod, we go to it or something like that. You guys corrected him too. We got this. It felt so real. Great job.
Yeah.
So sweet, right?
Nice.
Okay, well, to answer your question, we prepped it. We talked about this imaginary future.
We prepped the shit out of that.
Quite a bit.
We did.
You know, and I think, you know, the first step was Steve asked us all to come forward with ideas of news items, and that had to, of course, be elevated up to the, you know, to a future concept. It can't be like just a little bit iterated. It had to have like multiple jigs and jags. And the thing we've said many times is, you know, when you're coming up with a story, when we talk about movies and stuff like that, when you're writing a story, you've got to be one level deeper than what you're presenting. So the world that we created was actually bigger and more fleshed out than what we actually said on the show.
Yeah. We knew where we'd be going.
It allowed us to immerse ourselves.
We also followed the kind of yes and improv model. Yeah. Like, We didn't shut down anything that anybody said.
You built on it, yeah.
No contradictions, right.
Yeah, unless it was like for comic purposes.
And that's why we had to have like a foundation of the future of future history. Like, all right, guys, this is kind of the stuff that's happened that will happen over the next 15 years, so that when we did do the inevitable yes and, we wouldn't kind of like contravene what the agreed future history was going to be like in very broad strokes.
And a lot of people commented on kind of my news story, which was about the Og and the things that were happening within the Og. Yeah,
Control-Alt-Delete.
Control-Alt-Delete, an activist group. And it was pretty funny how that really resonated with people. But I love that. And just so that you guys know, we workshopped that, right? When we came up with that story, we all like contributed to come up, what is it going to be called and blah, blah, blah. But I love how in the vast majority of emails we got, people spelled Og O-G or O-G-G, kind of not realizing that the Og was augmented reality.
Yeah, right. A-U-G.
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 Yeah. A-U-G. Yeah.
So one final word about this is that like when people say like, oh, I don't like when you do the live episodes or whatever. It's like, okay, here's the thing. We put out 52 episodes a year. Most podcasts do not do that, especially ones that are homegrown, right? We don't have a big media company behind us. This is all just, it's just us. The way we do that is that when we're traveling and we're at live events, et cetera, we have to produce shows. So really, the option isn't between you get a live show or you get a studio produced show. It's you get a live show or you get no show.
Yeah.
And so we put out a live show. So when we do these live shows, sometimes we experiment, because if I have to put a show in the can to air 2 months later, we can't just do regular news items. We can't do Who's That Noisy out of sequence.
Yeah, so, we can't do like COVID-19, 12 deaths.
Yeah, I know. So we often
really make sense.
So sometimes, I mean, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of these because we're touring for the extravaganza, and we're going to be doing, like, if we record a show on Saturday, it's going up the next week, we'll do a regular show. If we're recording a show that might not come out for a month or two, we usually will experiment with something. And they usually turn out pretty good, but you gotta give us a little bit of slack, you know, that we're doing, we're breaking new ground here, we're trying, you know. So yes, we understand that the SGU 2035 show was totally experimental and not everyone was going to like the role playing. But I personally think that the show was a success. I think the feedback bears that out. Yes, some people didn't get it, but that's, hey, it was an experiment. You could skip that episode, because if we didn't do it, you would be getting nothing anyway, right? You have to look at it that
same
way.
Same outcome.
Yeah, double your money back,
way,
folks.
We were handicapped with illness during that episode, so I'm pretty damn proud of us. We were so many times covering our mics cough. Yeah, and
I edited most of that out, so people might not be aware of that. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is whales, because there just happens to be a lot of whale news items out there, so enough to make a science or fiction. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here we go. Item number one. Researchers find that California gray whales are over four times more likely to strand themselves during solar storms. Item number two, a new study involving sperm whales off the coast of New Zealand confirmed they are able to predict the onset of earthquakes better than any other animal tested. And item number three, a large sighting, the largest in decades, indicates a probable surge in the population of Antarctic blue whales. Evan, go first.
All right. California gray whales, four times more likely to strand themselves during solar storms. Why? Four times? Okay. What the heck are they detecting in the solar storms that makes them want to strand themselves? Ah, what is the connection there? That's a challenging one. Bobby, I need to do a Vulcan mind meld to your brain to get some more information about solar storms and all their properties, and maybe I would understand this better. I'll move on. The study involving the sperm whales off the coast of New Zealand, they're able to predict the onset of earthquakes better than other animals tested. I'm thinking this one's going to be science. You know, obviously New Zealand's right on the Ring of Fire, and, you know, hey, sperm whales are close to the action, as it were. So I wouldn't be surprised if they were able to make some predictions there, and they turned out to be correct regarding the behavior of the sperm whales. It would be behavioral, right? Is how they're able to realize what's going on there with the whales and their predictory powers of earthquakes. So I think that one's science. Last one, a large sighting, the largest in decades, indicates a probable surge in the population of Antarctic blue whales. Might this have something to do with climate change? Might this have something to do with warming oceans? That might be. I think I'll stick with that. So because I am kind of lost on this California gray whales one during the solar storms, even though it is like the craziest, I think, of the three, I have a feeling that one will turn out to be the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
So the first one about the researchers found that the California gray whales are over four times more likely to strand themselves during the solar storm. So yeah, I'm thinking like the solar storms might screw up their ability to navigate. I know that certain animals can detect magnetic north, or at least, you know, they have like some type of metal in their skull that gives them a sense of the magnetic field, and they use the magnetic fields. I've never heard anything about solar storms interfering with that, and I don't think I've ever heard anything about whales having that magnetic sense, which doesn't mean really anything other than I'm just, going through my head, like, what's the possibility here? I mean, I don't know. I'm pretty sure whales, do they navigate by sight in any way? I don't know. So that's an interesting one. The second one here, the sperm whales off the coast of New Zealand, and they confirm that they're able to predict the onset of earthquakes. Now, okay, we know that whales can communicate over vast distances. We are talking here about sperm whales. And I do think that sperm whales are the kinds of whales that communicate over vast different distances, which means that they probably have extraordinarily sensitive hearing, and that because the water could possibly act as like a giant microphone or speaker is probably more accurate. Those vibrations could travel a very long way. And it would also give them the ability to hear very subtle sounds. I don't know how they learn this. I mean, maybe the whale changed their behavior during, I don't know. It's crazy, but okay. That one has a footing in science, I think. And the last one here, the large sighting, in decades, probably surge in the population of Antarctic blue whales. Why is this a big deal? Is it the temperature? Is it global warming? I am going to say that I think the first one about the gray whales beaching themselves over solar storms, I'm going to say that one is science. And I'm going to say, son of a bitch. The solar storms one is the fiction.
Yes! Okay, so wow, 180, Jay.
Yeah, I know.
Right? That was awesome.
It's all quick, right, Bob.
It goes quick.
I don't even care if we're wrong now.
All right, search in the population of Antarctic blue whales. Sure, why not? Are there Antarctic blue whales? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe they're
that'd
just
be great
not
if that's
there.
Why it was the fiction.
Yeah, right?
I made that
hell,
whale up.
What the hell do I know where they are? So, but yeah, I could see that. Let's see. Predicting the onset of earthquakes. I could see that, especially considering you say than any other animal tested. I don't think any animal does a great job. But I could see some sort of connection. Possibly. I mean, that one's a little bit dicey, but not as dicey as the gray whales and the solar storms. I'm not really seeing any connection how they could determine that. Maybe it's lack of imagination. I'm not sure. Or it doesn't make as much sense to me. So I'll say that's fiction.
Oh, I'm so happy right now.
See what you went with the solar storms too?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And Kara.
I think I'm going to go out on a limb.
Don't. Oh, boy.
Kara.
Come back, Kara. It's not too late.
I know. Gosh. Don't. Okay. So I agree with the Antarctic blue whales. That's like seems like a no-brainer. It will be very funny if he sweeps us with that, though. The two that stuck out to me were the solar storms and the California gray whales, of course, and the sperm whales and New Zealand and earthquakes. And the reason that it's sticking in my craw is that you can't predict an earthquake. Like, it's one thing to say that these gray whales are having some sort of weird behavior because of a solar storm that I cannot explain why that would happen. Maybe Jay would be right. Maybe it's like a navigational fluke because of this like magnetic thing. We know that like big solar flares can actually affect, or coronal mass ejections can actually affect our electronics. So maybe there's something to be said about that. But The thing about earthquake prediction is it's not possible. Like, I don't think it's not, I don't think we don't have good earthquake prediction because we just haven't developed the technology. I think it's not possible because there is no indication that an earthquake is going to happen and then it happens. So the closest thing we have,
right?
Yeah, the closest thing we have to quote unquote prediction is early warning. And so I feel like if you're saying that these sperm whales feel the P wave first, like earlier than a dog or earlier, that would be one thing. But
you mean
there's
the ocean water gets warmer?
The P wave. That took me a second.
Aren't you splitting hairs here, Carrie? With your
no, I don't think so. That is not prediction. Like, that's just the beginning of the earthquake that people can't feel. So that's the thing. That's the same earthquake. And our tools can detect it, and sometimes animals can detect it. We just can't feel it. We don't feel it until the later part of the wave. But that wouldn't be prediction. That would just be they're feeling an earthquake. So for me, it's kind of like the devil's in the details. I don't think a sperm whale could predict an earthquake because I don't think anything can predict an earthquake. I think they're unpredictable by definition.
You sound very authoritative now, and I'm scared.
I did a big earthquake episode with Lucy Jones recently.
Oh, cool. There you go. All right. Yeah, well, have recent experience.
That's right.
I feel like, but we didn't talk about sperm whales, so I don't know.
All right.
That episode rocked.
You all agree with number three, so we'll start there.
Oh, boy.
A large sighting, the largest in decades, indicates a probable surge in the population of Antarctic blue whales. You all think that one is science, and that one is science. So that they were sighted near the island of Georgia, South Georgia, which is in the sub-Antarctic. And oh, cool. This is a known feeding ground for the Antarctic blue whales. Now, it's interesting that you guys were talking about like global warming and thinking this had to be a bad thing. This is a totally good thing.
Yeah, man. Biggest animal that ever existed ever.
The reason for the surge is because of the ban on hunting. That's it.
Oh, good.
Oh, good. That is good.
The ban on hunting is working. This is like the first real indication that the population is rebounding, maybe even to like really sustainable levels, you know? One expert was saying, like, you know, he's been looking for blue whales, you know, his whole career. Maybe you see one a year, you know.
Wow. And
this sighting, 55 at once. 55
wow.
Holy blue
shit.
Whales.
Whale oil for everyone.
And yeah, look, Bob, biggest whale, bigger, because blue whales are the biggest in Antarctic, are the biggest of the blue whales.
Oh, the biggest of the biggest. Awesome.
Biggest of the biggest.
Colossus.
Cool. It's, yeah, so they feed on the krill down there.
They feed on that krill.
Their krill. So it's been like 40 or 50 years, you know, since the...
That's awesome.
They basically banned hunting blue whales and other you know, large whales. And all the populations are coming back, actually, because of that. Except for some reason, the minke whales.
The minke whales?
The minke whales are having a problem still. But yeah, so that's really, really good news. Okay, let's go to number two.
All right.
A new study involving sperm whales off the coast of New Zealand confirm that they are able to predict the onset of earthquakes better than any other animal tested. Kara, you think this one is a fiction. The guys think this one is science. So Kara, I'm interested in the way you formulated this. So you're making a clear distinction between sensing the beginning of an earthquake and predicting an earthquake.
Yeah, because to me, once something's already happened, you're not predicting
it. So you're not willing to acknowledge that there are different phases where maybe there's like a pre-earthquake thing happening where rocks may be pushing against each other and producing sound that, say, a whale could hear but a human can't hear.
No, even though that's still part
the shaking
of the earthquake.
Hasn't started yet.
No, that if rocks are making sound, they're shaking to push together. That's still part of the earthquake. But I'm sticking with this idea.
Yes. Right. Not all rocks grinding together cause
because this one is the fiction because you're right.
Damn.
Yes.
Yeah, you cannot predict earthquakes. So no animal has really been shown to predict earthquakes. And the reports are all anecdotal and low quality. And so there's not really been established. And I couldn't find anything about sperm whales and earthquakes, predicting earthquakes. I totally made that up. But this was based on an actual news item. The news item is that earthquakes screw up the sperm whale's ability to hunt for up to a year.
Holy crap. How?
Yeah. It disrupts their ability to find food.
They're not really sure how.
I mean, it doesn't make it impossible for them to feed. It disrupts their feeding. Hmm. So they don't know why yet, but they're still trying to figure that out, but they've made that observation. But, you know, it could be that it disrupts the productivity of the food that they feed on or whatever. So it's...
So do they think that it's actually in the ecology? It's not like something physiological.
Right. Probably something in the ecosystem. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. All right. All that means that researchers find that California gray whales are over 4 times more likely to strand themselves during solar storms. Is science. It's actually 4.3 times more likely. And yes, they think this is completely related to disruption in the gray whale's ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field.
Go Jay. Thank
Jay,
you.
Jay, you were spot on. The reason that this is so important is because they swim in the open ocean. You know, there's like no references in the open ocean. The only way they know which way they're going is by sensing the magnetic field. Unless the only other way would be to surface and look at the sun, I guess. But
currents don't take. They can't sense currents and those things.
Yeah, I guess in the open ocean, you know, it's
yeah, the current in the open ocean is weird because there's like eddies and
it's not reliable. So they rely on their whale GPS. To navigate, during solar storms, there's just white noise, you know, in that frequency, and it disrupts their ability to sense the field. So anyway, that's the fact that they are more likely to strand themselves. That was the study. The reason is speculation, and they think it's because of their magnetic field sensing. That hasn't been proven, but again, that's not what I wrote. I wrote just that that the solar storms disrupt their ability to navigate. So. Yeah, very interesting. Whales have been one of my favorite animals going back to my, you know, very, very young age. So I always like to talk about whales. They are amazing animals. They really are. Not just because they're huge, but I mean, you know, their intelligence, the blue whales communicating. But, you know, they are having a hard time adapting to our modern technological world. I think the biggest problem right now, and this may be more in the humpback whales than any other whale, but also the blue whales, is that just the noise, just the ocean traffic is just making it impossible for them to communicate with each other.
Stuff. Yeah. It's so sad. I mean, because it's like such a fascinating concept that there are these abilities, these skills, these senses. Obviously, we talk about this a lot, that different organisms possess, that literally I would have no idea a solar storm was happening unless it disrupted like my cell phone. But I can't imagine. We just don't have that capability.
We don't have that sense. Yeah. It's a different
amazing
sense. Yeah.
I can't drive to the supermarket. There must be a solar storm.
Someday.
Well, I mean, it'd be like driving in a long distance in an unfamiliar territory without GPS or a map, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, or a map.
Yeah.
Or the sun.
On a cloudy day. On a cloudy day.
Yeah, there you go.
No compass.
At night, yeah.
Yeah.
With your eyes closed. So there you go.
So there you have it.
That's right. All right, Evan, do you have a quote?
I do have a quote. It was suggested by a listener, Anne-Marie. From Northern Virginia. Thank you, Anne-Marie. I like this quote. I think if you're spending more time denying evidence than looking for it, then you've probably left the path of intelligent skepticism. And those words were spoken by Alan Dove, who is a co-host on the weekly podcast This Week in Virology. He is a science journalist, a podcaster, a blogger, and an editor. And he lives in Western Massachusetts, so he's our neighbor.
Very cool.
Cool. Nice quote. I like it.
Good quote. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks,
you're welcome. Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.